Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrian Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News in Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for joining us this evening. It'll be a great show. First up, I'll be interviewing Executive Director of the Marine Exchange of Alaska and retired U.S. Coast Guard Captain Ed Page from 7 to 7:30. And in the second half of the show tonight, I'll be talking with Mike Bell, Director of the University of Alaska Southeast Center for Mine Training. Remember to look for the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. You can like the AIP, as we call it, and post a question there on my wall or suggest guests for the future. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And you can check out my blog each week for the recordings of the shows. You can find them there at adrianchile.blogspot.com. Thanks, everyone out there who came out to the World Quest event fundraiser last week. It was a great trivia night, and it raised a lot of money for the Juneau World Affairs Council, so I appreciate those listeners who attended and paid the high price of those tickets. Tonight, Ed Page, I'm going to read his bio here. He's got quite a life of accomplishment, so stay patient. Okay. Captain Ed Page is a retired Coast Guard officer who sailed on the Coast Guard cutter Boutwell from Boston to Juneau in 1973 and immediately fell in love with the great land. During his 29 years in the Coast Guard, he had several assignments in Alaska, including Anchorage, Ketchikan, and Juneau, that took him throughout the state. He's also served in Iwo Jima, Japan, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. While assigned as the captain of the port for Los Angeles, Long Beach, in the mid-90s, he worked closely with nonprofit marine exchanges, organizations that track and broker information on vessels' locations, and set a personal goal of starting up the first marine exchange in Alaska. The day after he retired in April 2001, he opened the doors of the Marine Exchange of Alaska that over the past 10 years has developed into one of the largest vessel tracking systems in the world, with over 85 automatic identification system receiving stations from Ketchikan, west to Adak, and north to Barrow, providing information on vessels that aid safe, secure, and environmentally sound maritime operations. Wow. I don't have to ask you any questions.
No, that's it.
That's
Can I go
it,
now?
I guess so. Just promoted everything you did. So, yeah. Well, I was going to ask you what brought you to Alaska. Obviously, you were on that first voyage in 1973, but you fell in love. Was it here in Juneau or as you went out to other places in Alaska?
Well, actually, the boats sail all through the Aleutian Islands and through Southeast Alaska. So
okay.
I was actually fascinated with it and came back, told my wife, said, this is really a great place. Let's try to explore a little bit further. And she was game enough to jump in a canoe with me and canoe the 530 miles of Yukon River and explore things. And we did kayaking, what have you. So she also developed appreciation for Alaska. So we decided to make it home. And throughout my career, we would tell the kids as we moved around, say, the home is Alaska. We may be in L.A. today, but our home was in Alaska or San Francisco or wherever, and that was the goal, and that's what we did.
Nice. You kind of brainwashed them, and did they like that?
Oh, yeah.
They were okay with it?
They live it to the fullest, and they really enjoy living in Alaska.
Very nice.
And so, outdoorsy folks and bicycling and kayaking and hiking.
Outdoors. Great. So did any of the people on that voyage or some of the people in the Coast Guard decide the same thing? Did people also share that appreciation?
Sure. A lot of Coasties in Juneau because who are not – originally from up here, but they're first exposed to Alaska and fell in love with it and kind of set the goal at the end of their wrap up their tour with the Coast Guard to try to settle here. So that's what my idea was. I'm going
to
start the Marine Exchange in Alaska.
Okay, great. Yeah. So experiences in the Coast Guard, you should touch on a little bit of this. You were in Iwo Jima, Japan. Does that system still in service, this Lauren station? I know there's a few around the world, right?
I broke it, and so they
it's gone.
well, that was actually in the mid-70s when we did have extensive chains, in the Europe and in the Far East, whatever. But GPS has kind of taken that role for the most part, and so it's pretty expensive sending a bunch of folks. We had 45 guys on a rock in Iwo Jima for a year. Isolated duty and all the cost of maintaining something like that, and they felt maybe there's less expensive ways of telling people where to go. So it's a good experience as far as knowing how to survive on a rock with a bunch of guys and keep their sanity.
Sounds like a reality show.
Yeah, it was. We should have had an island.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Coast Guard. I met a guy, or he's a friend of mine back in the North Carolina area, and his whole career in the Coast Guard was in Key West. And I always tell him, well, that's not real Coast Guard. Do you have,
oh, that sounds very real to me. I didn't call the shots well, I guess. But actually,
yeah, it's a nice life.
One of the young men who worked in our office, Ryan Farrell, for a while when he was in high school, worked in our office. And he got exposed to a lot of boats along with his dad and sailing and working in the Allen Marine, whatever. He's now sailing our ship out of Key West. So,
okay.
I think I need to go visit him or something like that. Sounds pretty nice to me. But it's a great outfit. I'm really forever grateful for what the Coast Guard exposed me to. As a young man, I love sailing. And so this kind of idea of really being starting Marine Exchange probably started 50 years ago when I was a young kid and as a sailor. And I became fascinated with boats and studied boats and read about boats and new statistics on boats. And I'm a very avid sailor, for that matter, and I saw the Coast Guard Cutter Eagle, which is a 300-foot sailing ship, and said, how do I get on that boat? And my dad said, I just go to the Coast Guard Academy, piece of cake, couple of years. And
there you go.
So I applied to the Coast Guard Academy. Everything's focused on going to the Coast Guard Academy as a young man, make sure I had plenty of sports and academics in my favor, and sailed on the Eagle, of course. And then from there on, I sailed on – sailed out of Boston and then up in Alaska. But it kept on exposing me to shipping and maritime interests and marine exchanges, which it's not a household name. Everybody seems to know what Google is. It doesn't make any sense. Marine exchange has been around 150 years. So people still don't know what it is. So maybe we should call it Kazam or something totally irrelevant, and maybe people would understand it. But marine exchanges really go back to the 1800s.
Okay.
And they exchange maritime information, so maybe we reword it somehow and say maritime information exchanges, maybe people would understand it.
Understand.
But back early on, like in San Francisco, people who were involved in trade with ships would kind of walk around and streets waiting for the ship to come and say, there's an easier way. You can go to the first Starbucks, if you will.
Yeah.
And we'll have some folks up on the hill, posted on the hill with a semaphore or a horse in some other ports. And they would actually see a vessel coming offshore, and they would semaphore across the bay, say the three-master southbound Black Hull, and they go, oh, that's my ship, pay for their coffee, and get their carts out, and start engaging trade. So they broker information is what they do.
Okay.
And there were marine exchanges throughout the country. And when I was in the Coast Guard, we would need information on the port or vessels. We would call the marine exchange because they were basically had a profound knowledge of their port because they stayed stable, unlike coasties. Once you figure it out, they move you to another location, give you more general understanding of areas, and which has its benefits but has its drawbacks too. So the marine exchange folks really understood their ports and were experts in as far as shipping activity. And I was captain of Port L.A. I became worked very closely with marine exchange, and we developed a joint Coast Guard, State of California, and marine industry vessel tracking system down in L.A.
In L.A.
But that was really just comprised of a 20-mile range radar, which would do you no good in Alaska. So
it's not very fun.
I decided that it'd be great to start a marine exchange for Alaska, but it was the most daunting and most challenging area you could possibly pick because you needed one for the whole state, and you only could do that with technology. So we're using technology to track vessels throughout the state. And for that matter, I get on my little phone here, I can tell you where ships are in Boston Harbor right now. So we actually have a phenomenal amount of information we've accumulated.
Information. So you retired from the Coast Guard and you decide this is your mission. You'd seen it as captain of the Port of L.A. And you wanted to get involved. Now, you say they're around the country. Are they funded by a certain group? Do the shipping companies pay for these exchanges?
There's three entities, maybe four entities that really are interested and have a need for maritime information. The state of Alaska has an interest because they run pilotage programs. They have the Department of Environmental Conservation, Natural Resources, Fish and Game, Marine Highway System. So they want to know where their ships and other ships are. The Coast Guard certainly does for the purpose of who they can call on. If vessels in distress, they want to know where they are and where vessels are nearby. The maritime industry wants it primarily for efficiency purposes. They want to know when the ship is at this point, they want to get the pilots out there. At this stage, they want a tugboat. At this stage, they want line handlers. At this stage, so at different points of the transit, there are different things that trigger it that have to be done. Basically, knowing where the ships are saves a lot as far as when the trucks show up and when the line handlers versus everybody showing up at the dock at the same time and staying there for hours waiting for the ship to arrive.
That doesn't make sense.
So we have the information. Within a couple seconds, we can tell you every couple seconds these positions are updated.
And,
So basically, what it comes down to those three entities, and that's really our predominantly a broker. We basically are a nonprofit organization. Says the three of you have a need, we'll bring you all together. We'll share the cost. We'll share the information,
mm-hmm.
and we'll broker this information that benefits all those parties
of everybody.
So it's a pretty simple concept.
Sounds
mechanics are extremely
nice.
Tough, but when it gets tough mechanics, I hire people smarter than me. I'm surrounded by people smarter than me.
Yeah.
They're easy to find. They all tend to be a little smarter than me, but I got some very, very savvy folks technologically and what have you.
So when you decided to found this one in Alaska, you found great people around you.
Well, I found a couple of Coasties to start off with.
Yeah.
I know what they're made out of. And there's one guy, Bill Benning, who headed up communications for Alaska. Another guy was search and rescue, Paul Webb. Really, the folks that were willing to stick their neck out and say, well, get out of the Coast Guard and try this, basically.
Yeah.
And so they both retired, and we built a very advanced, technologically advanced network using satellite systems and automatic identification systems, which are much like or similar to aircraft transponders, where vessels are actually sending out data every couple seconds. And we build up the network to receive that information
mm-hmm.
and then consolidate it and then servers and then make it available over the internet with a username and password so different entities can see that information. So we're looking at vessels up on the Arctic, not now because
yeah.
no one's up there. We did see the Renda and the Coast Guard cutter Healy when they were doing their operation here a couple weeks ago. But we're looking at vessels in Adak and Dutch Harbor and Ketchikan and throughout the state. And so it's valuable to a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, Alaska is such a big place. You must have had to start incrementally in these different places to build this network, right?
Right, right. So we started with kind of low-hanging fruit. Some people refer to it as the Friends of Ed system. I knew somebody lived near the water. They instantly became my friend. And next thing I was trying to put a tower next to her house and plug into their internet and what have you. So we started easy. But now we're at the very, very challenging. We have some very adventurous men who have no qualms about getting a backpack and flying a helicopter and stuck and sleeping outdoors, whatever, at abandoned lighthouses and what have you, and building sites on islands and basically building their own power plant because there's nothing there. So we're building solar panels and wind generator, installing them and digging holes. I'm proud to say I'm the senior post hole digger for the Marine Exchange of Alaska. I can dig, my old rusting skills come in handy. I can dig post holes and pour cement. But when they start playing with wires, whatever, they say, maybe you want to dig another hole over here or something like that. So,
well, what's your record time?
Days, unfortunately. Maybe it keeps in Alaska. I think I dug them all in one day and poured the concrete about midnight that night. So And we have our own boat, 32-foot landing craft, so we'll drive 300 miles down the coast and pull up the beach and drop off several tons of and haul it up the beach, batteries and concrete and panels and electronics and what have you, and then build a site. And then a couple days later, head out again back home, and we're looking vessels 100, 150 miles away, tracking them, and that's being fed to the Coast Guard and to the state and to the marine industry. So it's really gratifying because we know that these sites do, at times, have been contributing to saving lives. We only get assists.
Questions.
The Coast Guard's going to get the big save or some other mariner because they're actually going to put the line on. But we get the information that helps them go to the right location in time. And so we'll always get an assist. But that in itself is, for old retired Coast Guard captains, the best we can do at this point.
Yeah, so you have saved some lives. You have by finding a ship, right?
That's right, by helping the information that allows a vessel to do the rescue versus. And so we've had that instance where vessels have been saved and crews and oil pollution prevented because of the information we had was able to allow two vessels to get together and a rescue vessel to get there in time to keep it off the beach.
Those are good stories. It makes you feel good about what you do, right?
It is. It's very gratifying. Absolutely.
So this automated identification system, you mentioned it. Is this pretty much what you guys use? And how is this technology? Was this available 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
No, it wasn't. This is very new technology, actually. And it was just recently, about 6 years or 7 years ago, I gather now, that the International Maritime Organization adopted it through the international treaty, said this is the way we can improve maritime safety, environmental protection, and security, is knowing where ships are. And so all the ships around the world are required to have this equipment, and other ships can pick up that information. The challenge, though, is you want to have the shore infrastructure and the people like the Coast Guard want to have it, they really are challenged by having a huge network of receivers, extremely expensive. And while the Coast Guard wants to do it, And they've built it in the lower 48. It's just the cost is so high that Congress has kind of choked on it, said, you know, we're about to give them all the money we have at the moment. And so it's been delayed and delayed. Now 2017 is the latest thing I've heard, but it's, wow, it hasn't come online. So we've really just kind of accelerated implementation by doing kind of a hands-on work with the maritime industry. So we're on tug offices. We're at fish processing plants. Mm. We're at lighthouses. So we don't have the very expensive towers that you would see in the lower 48. We're just kind of building things and existing infrastructure and keeping a low-cost option. You know, we all like to have Mercedes or Volvos, but sometimes it's just to have a VW bug is the best you can do. And if you're just looking from getting A to B, then you know, we provide that
works.
Capability. But it's evolved that we're much more sophisticated now. Some of our crew was out for 2 weeks out of ADAC recently, and they up on the top of the mountain and stolen some very skookum stuff that looking 150, 160 miles offshore. And so we're really getting at the leading edge and pushing the envelope. But when we started, we just had to get something up and running and see if we can make it work. It has worked, but we're not done yet. We still got a lot more work to do.
Yes, I'm sure you do. Now, has this system, the AIS we call it, ever assisted in prosecuting environmental crimes at sea? This is a question from Rob Earl. Thank you very much.
Well, that's a good question. It can. It has potential to. I'd rather say the other way around. I'd rather say it may have the same influence that the police radar gun has on me, and that knowing that they're out there with a radar gun, I'm a little more attentive and a little more cautious and make sure that I do stay close to 55 miles an hour. I never go faster, of course.
Oh, really?
Not on radio. I wouldn't admit to that. But no, it's good having somebody looking over your shoulder sometimes. So if you think back to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, I don't necessarily call it an environmental crime. I think that was a misstep, obviously. But I don't think it was did with malice of forethought or what have you. The fact is that the Coast Guard was watching that transit up until Valdez Narrows, and there didn't see him anymore. Beyond the radar range, literally. They had a radar, and he was beyond the radar range. The law was he's supposed to be on the bridge. The law was supposed to stay in the channel. Nobody's watching. He says, well, I'm going down below. You guys steer out of the channel. And the rest is history. Had somebody been watching, probably wouldn't have happened. The Coast Guard had been watching. Similarly, the Costa Concordia. If that captain knew that the Home Office would be calling him the next day, say, I saw you get awfully close to that island. You want a job or not? But he figured, they don't know who I am. I'm going to do a little showboating or what have you. Of course, they did find out where he was after the fact. So I think the fact that the opportunity to kind of monitor vessels helps them compel compliance. We even have a speed. We have some zones that we have a whale restriction, whale areas that need to be protected. The Glacier Bay Park Service used to run around Boston whales with a radar gun pointing at cruise ships to make sure they're doing the speed limit. And we said, well, we could do that 24 hours a day without you going outside. We'll draw the square around the bay. How fast can they go? Okay. The alarms go off, and an email gets sent to Park Service if they're speeding. Guess what? They don't get any because everyone knows they're watching, and they're towing the line. So that's good. We can say, look, we're doing the right thing, and we have proof positive we're doing the right thing. So a couple of areas, we've set up those type of areas to be avoided, whatever. We can validate compliance. And people don't comply, well, then you say, well, let's squeeze a little bit harder. Let's push. Let's write tickets, what have you. But you have compliance. That's the real goal. It's not to generate tickets.
True.
Not to catch people. It's really to have people comply with the law that is intended to protect the environment. So we see it more of a tool to nudge compliance and validate compliance, for that matter.
That's a good perspective on that. So is the system also is there collaboration with other countries like Canada?
Yes, we certainly talked to them. We're actually looking their waters, and much like Sarah Palin, we too can see into Russia. We're watching ships in Russia as we speak. I can get on my iPhone right now, and I can show you some ships in Russia, for that matter. So we look in their waters. We've actually did some stuff as crazy as went down to the Galapagos Islands and Ecuador, because I was asked if by Department of Homeland Security, I got an email that says something along the lines that Ecuador had piracy problems and fishery collapse and needed a tracking system. Was I interested to speak Spanish? So my response was, no problema, mi casa su casa, dos cervezas por favor, and my bags are packed. That really was my answer. And we went down there and actually set up a system down there. So we've done a little bit international, but my assistant, who is much more focused than I am, Brett Farrell, says, keep focused on Alaska. stop getting strayed and stop going off these different adventures that we're not done yet. And he's absolutely right. We need to stay focused on the job at hand, and we've got plenty of work to do. So,
okay, Brett. Well, you got to break
better,
up the routine.
Me and so.
Ecuador's a little nice.
Yeah,
in
it
a
was
while.
Great.
In the winter here.
I had to have fun, and we had a lot of fun, but it's probably not we have many other things to do
more
up here.
More projects here in Alaska.
There's a lot of interest on the part of the state legislature and Commissioner Hartig from DEC, and even Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, as far as us working, and we have. We've met with and flown down to Victoria, working with the Canadians, and even for that matter, the Russians, to kind of extend our reach so that we can share information, because it's really this body of water is shared, and or other disasters that happen near each other's borders, we both want to play and participate in preventing them, and then responding more effectively by knowing where our resources are and putting them in the right place.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about full coverage, that Brett. Hi, Brett. No, I know Brett. We worked in the Maritime Festival last year together.
Oh, that's right. You know Brett, of course. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right. Well,
I never put the two and two together with the
Marine
Exchange.
No,
but no.
People would think we were together. So he's my alter ego. Yeah.
Now I know what you guys do.
He's grounded, and I'm a little, flaking it. But go ahead.
Yeah. So this full coverage of Alaska's coast, what percentage do you think you have covered right now? How much more
that's
work
a good question.
To be done?
We probably have somewhere in the neighborhood about 75% coverage. We've initially just focused on what are the really areas there's a tremendous amount of concern on, like the Bering Strait between Russia.
Okay.
So we focused on put a whole bunch of sites on that area. Up in the North Slope, a lot of interest in the Arctic. So we have several sites up in the Arctic, and we'll be going back and reinforcing and building further. We've been working closely with Shell on that. We looked at Dutch Harbor and Nunavak Pass, put a lot of emphasis on that in light of the Seladang IU incident several years ago and loss of life and loss of vessel and oil spill. Yeah. So we put attention on that.
Okay.
The Dixon Entrance in Canada is a high point. So we kind of look at trouble areas. Another one is cruise ships. That, there's a lot of concern and interest in the past about cruise ships and environmental protection. So we put a lot of emphasis ensuring that the cruise ship routes are covered for a couple of reasons. One is if they're God forbid there is an accident.
Yeah.
You really want to know where they are and where other vessels can assist. And the other one is to put people at ease that they really are towing the line and do what they're supposed to be doing. So they can validate that they went out the right areas for when they did the permitted discharges and what have you.
Mm.
And so
so you work with the cruise ship captains on some of this as
I don't necessarily work with the captains as much as for us, the cruise industry and others. But so we focused on the areas that are search and rescue cases. If there are bad search and rescue cases that hits a chord with some of us because we were personally involved and lives are lost. And I said, let's make sure we got good coverage of Frederick Sound because several people lost their lives down there. So we focus on areas first that have a higher need of tracking. In other words, there's not much going on. And so we're now going back and filling the gaps, saying here's some other areas we'd like to have coverage. Not much has happened in the past. Not a lot of interest and pressure having it, but we're trying to have complete coverage. It makes the best sense. So we are working at it. But it's a big state.
Yeah, it is a big state. And do you hear from your stakeholders out there or the people that say, hey, you guys should be thinking about this and you just
– All the time,
your priorities are elsewhere. And
everyone's got a great idea where we need to be next and which mountaintop we need to be on top of and what have you, which is good because we run on a lot of those leads. We take those leads and run with them. And we just can't run with all of them or some are a little bit – too daunting, and it's going to take us a while to get there. But we have all kinds of input. As a nonprofit, we have to have a board of directors, and so we have representation of the pilot associations and the container lines and tanker lines and tugboats and ports. And I'm sure I'm missing some fishing industry.
The fishing industry.
And so they all use the system, benefit from the system, and unfortunately all have good ideas. And so I don't want to meet with them too often because my work list gets too large.
We'll have expectations.
But, they've been very, very supportive. Actually, my board president, Paul Foos, has been passionate about this for 10 years now. And and he's a big idea man. It's the only thing I can say bad about him. He's got lots of ideas, and it's pretty hard to keep up with him. And but he's a mover and shaker, and we wouldn't be here today if we'd have someone like him that really knew the lay of the land and served as a mayor of Dutch Harbor and Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, and just a long-time Alaskan, basically lifetime Alaskan. And so he knows the lay of the land and was very helpful. We sat at a bar, which we do our best thinking at, from 12 years ago, and we had put together on some ship disasters years ago where he was a diver and is actually involved blowing up ships for the Coast Guard. And I was in the Coast Guard hiring him to do such things, crazy things. And but we sat in a bar and agreed that we could probably pull this Marine Exchange off if we got together and get the right people. So my point is I have a lot of input from the Maritime Ministry, and we travel all over. We probably travel 100,000 miles a year. My staff, it's only 15 people. So we travel all throughout the state, you know, Adak to Ketchikan, all the way down up to Kaktovik and Barrow. So we really know the waterfront quite well. We don't have anybody in the interior, but we certainly know the people along the waterfronts and the ports.
So. So I'm interested, and for those tuning in recently, this is Ed Page. He's Executive Director of the Marine Exchange, also retired Coast Guard Captain. You know, I'm from Valdez. My dad was port director during that oil spill. And,
You said it
wasn't a crime. I mean, I don't know. If there would have been boom maybe on hand instead of in the storage units.
Oh, it was a crime in that kind. But obviously it wasn't a crime the criminal nature were.
But Tom Gimmel, who I did, he said send me some questions. And he said you had a big role in the Exxon Valdez. And there were some lessons learned that
big
maybe.
Big role after the fact, not in the Exxon Valdez.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
be very clear. So lessons learned after, as you were involved with the cleanup efforts being in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, well, I was definitely involved in that, and it was quite disruptive to me and my family because I just essentially got
– You were gone.
You know, I was in Ketchikan. He said, pack your bags, get on a plane tonight and get involved in that spill, and I was involved for several years. But I clearly learned that recovering oil is a – almost mission impossible. You can spend 3 years and $3 billion and maybe pick up 10 or 15%. But the smart thing is not let it get in the water the first time.
Yeah.
In the first thing. So prevention, I became a real advocate of prevention. And over my Coast Guard career, as a younger officer, I loved the fires and the sinkings and the groundings and search and rescue cases and the adrenaline rush and oil spills. But as I got older and more mature, I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way because some of those didn't go well and some people did die in the process. And those are the things that really hit a chord with me as far as saying, how do we prevent that from happening? In fact, I just happened to open my file drawer the other day and saw this old case I wrote up about there were some people who died, which is still, that was like 20 years ago, still is influencing what I do today. I still refer to that case and think of it and how do we prevent those things from happening again. So prevention is really the takeaway for me in the Exxon Valdez, don't let it happen.
And
because and there are ways to prevent that from happening for closer monitoring and attention. So thank God that they've closed the barn door now anyway, you know. And the other thing about that is that 99.9% success is equals public outrage. It's a zero tolerance there. I mean, 99.9% of the ships are making just fine. They had 8,000 transits over whatever it was, 20 years, got through with no – so one messed up. That's not acceptable. You know, it's a very high-stakes game. You can't even have one mess up. So as a result, you need to really have the scrutiny that and oversight, which has been done after the fact.
Yeah,
people recognize that.
Of course. Right. So – a little fun question on the Coast Guard Alaska show, which my first person related to the Coast Guard on the show, so I've been wanting to ask this kind of – have you seen the show, and is this really reality that's going on?
It's aviators. They always get all the glory. It's all about
aviators. The helicopters.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I didn't – to be honest, I don't watch it that much. I've seen a little bit of it, but I'm sure it's pretty real. And actually, I've flown with aviators, and they are very – very professional, very sharp, very dedicated, and so I suspect it's all well deserved. Actually, they are. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of Hollywood injected in that make it case. But the Coast Guard's a bunch of do-gooder people. You know, it's kind of like it's mother and apple pie, and they join the Coast Guard not because it's a big bucks, because they can actually make a difference, whether it's protecting the environment, or saving lives, or supporting that thing. So it's really a great outfit because the people have some, you know, a very noble reason to be in there. Yeah. And there's a lot of sacrifice done.
Yeah.
But then again, the other services have definitely on par, if not even more so in some cases. So
that's a message that could be communicated even more. I mean, if you think about funding and that, we didn't even get to the Arctic questions, you guys need more funding for some of these, you know, icebreakers and the work you do.
I think absolutely. You look about the icebreaker thing; it's not all that terribly novel idea. If you look at the Great Lakes, providing great icebreaker support since World War II to facilitate trade. So now we say, can we maybe have an icebreaker to help facilitate our trade a little bit? And it's a national news, but it's a routine day to day business in the Great Lakes or even the East Coast to open rivers get oil barged in New York and deliver fuel or whatever. So, yeah, I think that's a good argument. I'm hoping that the coast can prevail. And there's a lot of other reasons why we should have that, just to, aside just from facilitating trade. But, yeah, you know, there's an issue about whose territory, whose waters are these, and so it's jurisdictional issues, what have you. So the only challenge is they're spending, and we're broke. So it's shifting priorities and making it accommodate. So anyway, I'm hopeful that's the case. Yeah.
I hope so, too. So we've got to end this half-hour interview, good, Ed. But if anybody's interested in finding out more information or participating in the Marine Exchange, you know, you're always open to feedback from the public. And
yeah,
they can go on your website, which is?
www.mxak.org.
MXAK.org.
Right there next to the bridge and above the Juno Electronics. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So great. Thanks for all your contributions as well to our state and our country.
The opportunity to talk.
Yeah, thanks again.
My passion, if you will.
We've been speaking with Ed Page, former Coast Guard captain, U.S. Coast Guard captain, and executive director of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. Stay tuned. In the next half hour, we'll be speaking with Mike Bell. He's director of the UAS Center for Mine Training. We'll be right back.
A little bit of soul will wash away your lipstick on my face, but a little bit of soul will never, 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 ever erase the pain in my heart and my eyes as I go through the lonely hills. A little bit of soul will never wash away my tears. A little bit of soul will wash away powder from my chin. A little bit of soap will never, 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 ever begin to take away the hurt that I feel as I go through the lonely hills. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears.
Have you heard when love begins to die, it leaves someone to cry
night and day?
Like a bird, you left your robin nest, and just like all the rest, you flew away.
A little bit of soul will take away your perfume eventually. But a little bit of soul will never wash away the memory of your name in the night that I call through the lonely hills. A little bit of soul wash away my tears. I'll never lose the memory of your name in the night that I call through the lonely hills. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears.
Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned there. In the first half hour, we were talking with former Coast Guard Captain Edward Page. He is now the Executive Director of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. Some interesting stories from him. And remember, if you missed an interview, either tonight or in the past, you can go on to the KTOO News website and listen to the recordings. Or you can also go on to my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, and find the recordings for my guests in the past. Mike Bell is here in the second half of the show tonight. He arrived in Southeast Alaska from Oregon in the spring of 1967, long time ago, before I was born, to work for Clear Creek Logging Company and worked for the Alaska Pulp Corporation as well until 1981. Later, he formed Bell Engine and Equipment Repair Incorporated, also known as Freeman Bell, right, in 1981, owning and operating machine shops in Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Juneau, machining and repairing mechanical components for the fishing, logging, construction, and mining industries. In 2006, he became an assistant professor of diesel technology at the University of Alaska Southeast, and after retiring from that position in 2001, he became the director of the UAS Center for Mine Training. Thank you for coming on the show, Mike.
Well, thanks for asking me on.
And coming in to talk about your passion and what you've been doing to help local kids and really inspire mining in Southeast.
Oh, there are a lot of things going on. And when I retired from teaching, I like my students. I miss that already.
Do you?
Yeah, they're a good bunch. And we went through, used a lot of tactics to train them on diesel technology and help them get jobs in the mining industry. And they come back and see me, a lot of them, and say thanks, and that's cool.
That's very gratifying,
But when after I retired, we were just starting up the mine training center, and there hadn't been a director yet. So they offered that job. I thought about it because I went out to my machine shop after I'd retired from teaching and sat back for a couple of days and thought, this is pretty cool. Mm. All I have to do now is just this one job.
Instead of a lot of other things.
Yeah. And but they talked to me a little bit about it, and it's a great opportunity to help a project get started.
Definitely, definitely. So you were there at its inception.
Yeah, at the beginning.
And it kind of guided the objectives of the center. What is it about for those out there going, wait, I didn't know this existed in Juneau?
The Center for Mine Training is kind of interesting. It's, first off, it is a specific entity that is University of Alaska Corporate in Anchorage and Mining and Petroleum Training Service out of Kenai, which does the safety training, MSHA, they call it. It's Mining Safety and Health Administration federal training.
Okay.
And then the University of Alaska Southeast. So we have a three-part. We have three directors, so to speak. I'm the on-site director here at the actual training facility. And so what do we do there? Well, MAPS, the Mining and Petroleum Service people, run through about 700 people a year, training them for safety in mines because by federal law, you can't go out to a mine and work unless you have this safety training.
Yeah,
you have to have a certificate. I have to have one to go out to the mines, too. Everyone does. So we have that, and they train them in that. They also then run some classes that are called entry-level mining classes.
Entry-level, okay.
And the entry-level means you take someone who has never been around a mine, and you give them enough basic knowledge, including the safety factor, of course, stressing safety really a lot. You teach them the nomenclature and how to get around in a mine, how to survive. Possibly in an accident, where to go, things like that. And so in order to do that, well, obviously down in a classroom here across from Juneau Douglas High School where we have our classes, it'd be kind of hard to really bring home the experience of being inside of a mine.
Yeah.
Right. But through an agreement with some other local businesses, the university has leased the AJ mine, so we can actually go inside of inside of what's called the Sheep Creek Adit. It's a portal, a hole in the side of the mountain that's up at the top of Sheep Creek, and take the miners in there and they can find out what it's really like. And that training is pretty intense. You know, I forgot another partner, and I never want to forget them. There, we have this memorandum of agreement between the three entities I said. However, the Department of Labor is a silent partner, so to speak. I don't know if they're silent or not, but anyway, they're another partner.
The DOL.
Yes.
And they've participated in this as well.
And so this is kind of how that works. About twice a year, partly because of the snowfall now doesn't allow us to go up. So when the snow's gone from that Sheep Creek area, then we can go up and train people. The Department of Labor and the two mines, Kensington and Greens Creek, will meet with MAPS people and University of Alaska people and determine how many people the mines think they could hire.
Okay.
Okay. And because it'd be a shame to hire or to train 25 people and then only have five of them get a job. So the mines determine that. Then the Department of Labor comes up with the funding for it, and we train them. And it's a very intense training. It's kind of like boot camp on steroids. It really is, you know. Generally, it's a 5 to 6 week course. The last one was 3 weeks long. It was 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So for 21 straight days, these students had to be here, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning and go through all of the safety training, and then have to go up to the mine and put that experience to work and help each other. And
wow. So over 3 weeks.
Stuff.
Yeah, you said at Rotary, when I heard you speak,
much,
that one kid, he was late on the last day, and
there are very strict rules. One of the very strict rules is that you cannot be late.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're late, you wash out.
Yeah.
So, if you go 20 days and then you're 10 minutes late, it's a shame. But it's a real training experience for a real job. And the boats that go to Greens Creek and Kensington do not leave it a minute after the hour. They leave when they leave.
On time.
And if you're not there, you're not of much value.
So, yeah. So that's the way it is. It's a real life experience.
Yeah. It doesn't mean they can't redo it and try it again.
But, try it again in the future.
Yeah, if anybody out there listening and think they want to be a miner, bear in mind that there are some really strict rules like that. There are some other ones too. Drug use, for example, is absolutely not allowed in the mines. Mm. So they do a drug test, and it goes back many months because they they use a hair follicle test, and it's pretty thorough. So that's another one. If you're listening, if you want a job in the mines, lead a good life. Come on out. Pays good money though when you get it.
Yeah, well, that's an incentive. I mean,
they're probably starting out. I would just say that those the nine people that graduated and got jobs in the mine probably could expect, as an entry level miner, the first year $72,000.
Wow.
And they will work 2 weeks on and have a week off, so they're working 2/3 of a year for that amount of money.
And these aren't just jobs, underground. There's also jobs in the offices, right?
Well,
Actually, majority of them.
We're training in this case now. That's that one. That's underground miners. And so those people are going to start out being laborers, putting up pipes and things like that, and mm-hmm. then driving a truck, and then maybe driving what they call a mucker. We call a mucker. Canadians call it scoop tram, and Canadians call it something else. Or not Canadians, but Australian. But anyway, it's an underground loader, like a front-end loader. Scoops up the rock rubble and puts it in a truck. So that's kind of the second thing, and then you move on to a driller. So that brings up a whole nother thing. We have this brand new simulator thing you may have heard about. That's part of our training program.
The art.
About $840,000 worth of equipment that came in since December. And what it is, the best I could say is, if you've been to Disneyland, it's like one of those rides that bounces you around and makes you a real experience.
Gets you sick.
So, it does. It's some people do complain about that after about 20 minutes, that it's a little bit too much motion, a little too much simulation from the rocks going by your ears and things happening. But it's like being in an underground haul truck is one of the simulations. They get in there, and once we boot it up, it's 270 degrees of screens all around them, so it's just like being inside of the cab. And when they start the truck, it makes a starter sound and makes the engine sound. And when they step on the throttle, of course, it revs up. They have to shift the gears and work the engine brakes and the brake pedals and horns and lights and all of that stuff. So that's all pretty easy. Then they have to drive this big old truck down through this tunnel that's about 15 feet wide and 15 feet tall without hitting the walls, hopefully, and without breaking the tires. So we can give them a flat tire, or if they're really bothersome, we can catch the truck on fire.
So you're outside kind of monitoring?
We are outside on two other TV screens. And one of the TV screens has the training exercises on it. That's the trainer is actually running them through some system and some progression of training from very beginner to maybe an experienced truck driver that wants to learn some new techniques.
Okay.
And then you can flip in these faults. You can, if they're getting fairly confident, you can flip a little, take the mouse and click on a pedestrian. He suddenly steps out and oops. In front of a truck that is hauling 40 tons of ore, yeah.
So then they killed someone, hypothetically.
What happens is that they slam on the brakes and this thing lurches forward. And, of course, they're on this live thing that makes they feel every rock they go over. So when they slam on the brakes, it tips forward. And they have a seatbelt on, but quite often they still – something hits a windshield. I don't know if it's their heads or what, because it shatters and you see all this glass breaking stuff. No one gets hurt.
No one gets hurt. It's just
and the whole idea
it's a simulator
is,
for those tuning in later.
That's right. But yeah, it's very realistic. There's another simulated program for the scoop, for the mucker to dig up the ore. So they can practice on that. And then there are some fairly sophisticated drilling programs, which should be a great financial gain to the mines, because people can come in and train on that without tearing up equipment, which is the point of the whole thing.
Yeah.
If a haul truck costs $1 million, and even though the simulator is fairly expensive, but if we can run 25 or 50 people or whatever through there, that's like $50 million worth of truck.
That saves a lot of money.
And they can learn how not to tear up the tires or break things and how to operate them successfully. It's of great value.
Yeah, definitely.
So the Department of Labor likes it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this is the only university in the United States with this technology, right?
That's absolutely right. And there was a comment that this was somewhere that this was the first one in North America. That's not so, because they have some up at Whitehorse.
And Whitehorse, okay, because North America is Canada too, and Mexico.
Yeah, and we're we're kind of trading back and forth a little bit with Yukon safety people, and it's establishing a new relationship with them, which is good because it's all training. People work back and forth across borders.
Yeah, of course. So this technology comes in, and you had South Africans in town this week. That's why I was hoping to get them on the show too. But
you were.
It's just fine.
They were willing to come in. The deal with the South Africans was that this equipment is made in Durban, South Africa.
In Durban.
And so the technicians are from there. The corporation that we purchased from was called Thorotech. So these two fine young men came over, and actually one of the guys brought his sister with him and to see about America also. And they went to Yukon first, worked at Whitehorse. So they have to go and take this new equipment, put it all together, test it out, make sure it works, commission it. What they call it.
Okay.
Okay, so they did that. They did some in Whitehorse, and then they came down here, and they were here a week, in which time they put our three units together, tested them out, and tried to make sure there were no bugs, but of course there will always be one or two.
Were there?
But it's just computers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very realistic. But one of the neat things that I thought that happened there is that the Rotary Club has a young woman that is going next year to South Africa. I have no idea which city. She didn't know which city.
She didn't know yet, yeah.
Yeah. But she was her parents are naturally a little concerned.
Yeah.
Probably a good word. She's 15 years old, I believe, so that would be a concern, all right. Anyway, the technicians from South Africa and the sister got together with Rebecca Ord, the girl that's going to South Africa, a young woman, and talked with her family and kind of reassured them and and some friendships were formed, I think.
Great. So yeah. South Africa is...
Because that's a long ways from home.
It is. It's a long ways from everywhere in the world. Yeah. It's a hard place to get to. So these guys were in town. They had a great visit. They put together the simulator for you guys. And now is this open to the public? Could I go and look at this or play around?
Well, we're... We have several openings planned. Okay, we're still working out the bugs of it. If you wanted to come over and see how it worked, and it was at a time when we weren't doing something else. I would be glad to give you a tour, and you could see how you could drive the truck. There will be several stages of unveiling of it. I think probably and.
Next few months.
The best I could say would be that probably about the middle of March, we'll probably have a Saturday or whatever where it'll be open to the public and they can come down and see. But I haven't established that date yet. There's still a couple little things that don't work perfect every time, and that's a little concern. But it's fixable. It's just
great.
Hasn't been worked out.
So having this technology, this simulator, do you think it will attract students into this mining center and to take careers in mining? I mean, have you talked to students that are excited about this and training on it?
Well, people are excited about it, and I think maybe the trainers are the most excited because you can show them something, and they can have a horrible wreck, and no one gets hurt, and no equipment gets broken. So that's great.
That's a good point.
Where I would hope this would go, I hope my friends at the Department of Labor will take this the way I mean it. Our primary charge is to train Alaskans for Alaskan jobs, and it's very important because so much of the money goes out of the state of Alaska to other states from mining and from oil. So that's our primary charge, and that's why they put their money into it, the state did. By the same token, we can bring money into the state by training people from outside of the state or outside of the nation with the same equipment. So we have had requests from two places, one from Pakistan for a group to come over and another for some people from Mongolia to come over, and there are big mines starting up in Mongolia. And I see that as an avenue of increasing the – bringing money into Juneau.
Yeah, economic development here.
Yeah, I do. However, the Department of Labor certainly wants us to concentrate on training a local workforce.
Okay.
So to do that, and there are only so many entry-level jobs. In this area last year, maybe 19. So that's not a lot.
Between both mines, yeah.
We have new mines coming up on Prince of Wales. There's a Niblack gold mine. It's actually a polymetal mine like Greens Creek.
Okay.
And then Bokan Mountain, which is a rare earth mine, but both are underground. And there are some others, quite a few around the state that are opening up. And they're looking at needing 5,000 to 7,000 more people for these mines that the Department of Labor is within the next 5 to 6 years. So we can't train that many people here. But
yeah.
Fairbanks is at the university. They're working on these things too, and probably there will be a training facility even in Anchorage to try to meet the need. But that all being said, there are many jobs in mining, and you touched on it a little bit earlier when you said, well, not all of these jobs are underground, and that's right.
Mm-hmm.
The entry-level miners are underground. But if you take Greens Creek, for example, and I hope I'm close to accurate here. I know that they have now about 330 people, but let's just say that they had 100 people. If they had 100 people working there in relation to the ratios right now, I would say that about 30, 31 people would be working underground, and the other 69 to 70 would be above ground being supportive of that underground operation.
Yeah.
So when you talk about miners, it doesn't just mean underground people. It means cooks and geologists and
health and safety,
truck drivers and things on the surface and people in the milling processes and ship loading and all of that stuff, and it all has to work together. And everyone that works at a mine is a miner. I worked at the Greens Creek mine for 5 years, which I didn't put down in my thing, but
no.
I did. I went out there about around 2000 and worked there for 5 years as a machinist, which was just same thing I was doing in my business. And they told me I was a miner, and I thought, well, I'm not a miner. I'm a machinist. But but you have to follow the same safety things and all of the same rules. And pretty quick, this may sound corny, but it's not. The mining community is a very close-knit community, maybe because of the dangers involved, maybe because of the number of hours that you spend with people. Mm-hmm. But now, 7 years later, I still meet on a daily basis people that I worked with out there that I haven't seen for 4, 5, 6 years, and they always, you know, want to know how I'm doing and when I'm coming back. And you know, it's a close family.
Wow.
It really is.
Very neat.
So now, one, can I keep going here?
I'm about to run out. You're a great talker, Mike.
You didn't get to ask any
Mike
questions.
Mike Bell, director of the U.S. Training Center, or the U.S. Mine Center for Mine Training. But yeah. Keep going. We have about a couple more minutes.
Okay, well. Yeah. So Greens Creek put their money, so to speak, where their mouth is, and gave our program $300,000 to train a workforce. It's very difficult to get local people that are trained in the mining occupations, and there are a lot of them, whether it be geologists or environmental scientists or whatever, a nurse, you know, medical people, HR people. So they gave that gift to the university. And I have built a program for that with the help of many other people, but it's to train high school juniors and seniors on the potential occupations that they could follow. And right now, I just finished with a class just like an hour ago, the sixth class in our series of 24 dual credit, three college credit, half a high school credit class for 20 students. They're all in there. They're scholarships for the class from Greens Creek and, as a matter of fact, from another group called Southeast Conference. It's all paid for.
That's
for them.
Awesome.
And they're going in and exploring things from all of the aspects, all of the kinds of jobs. Today was a kind of a special day, and I've had a lot of really good people come in and talk about their jobs. But today, Bill Brophy, the Vice President of Public Relations for Usability Coal, caught a plane in Fairbanks, flew down to Anchorage, flew down to Juneau, came down to my class, taught my class. Tomorrow morning we'll jump back in a plane and go back up, talking about what a good company Usability is and how coal works in our world, but also talking about environmental science and the potential for jobs in that field.
And,
stuff like
well,
that.
That's so great. So high school students, you're reaching out to them to think about future careers.
All works together.
You guys are really making an impact, not just in Juneau, but all over the Southeast and our state, Mike.
Thanks.
Have to end our show, but people can go onto the University of Alaska website, Southeast, and look for more information on that.
They can. So. We have a website just on the if you have high school students, and that's a 3-year program, so it's going to be going the next 2 years for high school juniors and seniors, chance to get a job.
Great. Mike Bell, director of the Center for the UAS, Center for Mine Training, correct?
That's it.
At the University of Alaska Southeast. This is Adrian Lopez on the Alaska Identity Project. Thanks for staying tuned. We'll see you next week.
Part of the U.S.